Then. Sandy was there when it started, the only one who was. In later years, he would say, half-joking, that it was his one claim to fame. The others arrived on the scene soon enough, but to begin with, it was only Sandy Fremont Dearborn, standing by the gas pump with his mouth hung open and his eyes squinched shut, sure that in another few seconds the whole bunch of them, not to mention the Amish and the few non-Amish farmers in the area, would be so much radioactive dust in the wind. It happened a couple of weeks after the Buick came into Troop D's possession, around the 1st of August in the year 1979. By then, the newspaper coverage of Ennis Rafferty's disappearance was dying down. Most of the stories about the missing state trooper appeared in the Statler County American, but the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette ran a feature piece on the front page of its Sunday edition at the end of July. "Missing Trooper's Sister Left with Many Questions," the headline read. And beneath that, "Edith Hyams Calls for Full Investigation." Overall, the story played out exactly as Tony Shaindinks had hoped it would. Edith believed the men in D Troop knew more than they were telling about her brother's disappearance. She was quoted on that in both papers. What was left between the lines was that the poor woman was half out of her mind with grief, not to mention anger, and looking for someone to blame for what might have been her own fault. None of the troopers said anything about her sharp tongue and nearly constant fault-finding, but Ennis and Edith had neighbors who weren't so discreet. The reporters from both papers also mentioned that, accusations or no, the men in Ennis's troop were going ahead with plans to provide the woman with some modest financial support. The harsh black-and-white photo of Edith in the Post-Gazette didn't help her case. It made her look like Lizzie Borden, about 15 minutes before she grabbed the hatchet. The first likequake happened at dusk. Sandy had come off patrol around 6 that evening in order to have a little chat with Mike Sanders, the county attorney. They had a particularly nasty hit-and-run trial coming up. Sandy, the prime witness for the prosecution, the victim, a child who had been left a quadriplegic. Mike wanted to be very sure that the coke-snorting Mr. Businessman responsible went away. 5 years was his goal, but 10 wasn't out of the question. Tony Shaindinks sat in on part of the meeting, which took place in a corner of the upstairs common room, then went down to his office while Mike and Sandy finished up. When the meeting was over, Sandy decided to top up the tank in his cruiser before hitting the road for another 3 hours or so. As he walked past dispatch toward the back door, he heard Matt Babicki say in a low, just talking to myself voice, "Oh, you fucking thing!" This was followed by a whack. "Why don't you behave?" Sandy peeped around the corner and asked if Matt was having that delicate time of the month. Matt wasn't amused. "Listen to this," he said, and boosted the gain on his radio. The squelch knob, Sandy saw, was already turned as far as it would go toward the plus sign. Brian Cole checked in from Unit 7. Herb Avery, from 5 out on the Sawmill Road. George Stankowski, from God knew where. That one was almost entirely lost in a windy burst of static. "If this gets any worse, I don't know how I'm going to keep track of the guys, let alone shoot them any information," Matt complained. He slapped the side of his radio again, as if for emphasis. "And what if someone calls in with a complaint? Is it getting ready to thunderstorm outside, Sandy?" "It was clear as a bell when I came in," he said, then looked out the window. "Clear as a bell now, too. As you could see if your neck had a swivel in it. I was born with one, see?" Sandy turned his head from side to side. "Very funny. Haven't you got an innocent man to frame or something?" "Good one, Matt. That's a very snappy comeback." As he went on his way, Sandy heard someone upstairs wanting to know if the damn TV antenna had fallen down because the picture had all of a sudden gone to hell during a pretty good Star Trek rerun, the one about the Tribbles. Sandy went out. It was a hot, hazy evening with thunder rumbling off in the distance, but no wind and a clear sky overhead. The light was starting to drain away into the west, and a ground mist was rising from the grass. It had gotten to a height of maybe 5 feet. He got in his cruiser, D-14 that shift, the one with the busted headrest, drove it across to the Amoco pump, got out, unscrewed the gas cap under the pull-down license plate, then stopped. He had suddenly become aware of how quiet it was. No crickets chirring in the grass. No birds singing anywhere around. The only noise was a low, steady humming, like the sound one hears if one is standing right under the county power lines or near an electrical substation. Sandy started to turn around, and as he did, the whole world went purple-white. His first thought was that clear sky overhead or no, he had been struck by lightning. Then he saw Shed B lit up like... But there was no way to finish the simile. There was nothing like it, not in his experience. If he had been looking at those first few flashes dead on, he guessed he would have been blinded, maybe temporarily, maybe for good. Luckily for him, the shed's front roll-up door faced away from the gas pump. Yet still the glare was enough to dazzle his eyes and to turn that summer twilight as bright as noonday. And it made Shed B, a solid enough wooden structure, seem as insubstantial as a tent made out of gauze. Light shot through every crack and unoccupied nail hole. It flashed out from beneath the eaves through a small cavity that might have been gnawed by a squirrel. It blazed at ground level, where a board had fallen off, in a great, brilliant bar. There was a ventilator stack on the roof, and it shot the glare skyward in irregular bursts like smoke signals made out of pure violet light. The flashes through the rows of windows on the roll-up doors front and back turned the rising ground mist into an eerie electric vapor. Sandy was calm, startled, but calm. He thought, "This is it. Motherfucker's blowing. We're all dead." The thought of running or jumping into his cruiser never entered his head. Run where? Drive where? It was a joke. What he wanted was crazy. To get closer. It drew him. He wasn't terrified of it, as Mr. D had been. He felt the fascination, but not the fear. Crazy or not, he wanted to get closer. Could almost hear it calling him closer. Feeling like a man in a dream, it crossed his mind that dreaming was a serious possibility. He walked back to the driver's side of D-14, leaned in through the open window, and plucked his sunglasses off the dashboard. He put them on and started walking toward the shed. It was a little better with the sunglasses, but not much. He walked with his hand raised in front of him and his eyes narrowed down to stringent slits. The world boomed silent light all around and throbbed with purple fire. Sandy could see his shadow jumping out from his feet, disappearing and then jumping out again. He could see the light leaping from the windows in the roll-up door and glaring off the back of the barracks. He could see troopers starting to spill out, pushing aside Matt Babicki from dispatch, who had been closest and who got outside first. In the flashes from the shed, everyone moved herky-jerky, like actors in a silent film. Those who had sunglasses in their pockets reached to put them on. Some of those who didn't turned and stumbled back in to get them. One trooper even drew his gun, looked down at it as if to say, "What the fuck am I going to do with this?" and put it back in his holster. Two of the troopers without sunglasses groped gamely on toward the shed nevertheless, heads down and eyes shut and hands held out before them like the hands of sleepwalkers, drawn as Sandy had been toward the stuttery flashes and that low, maddening hum, like bugs to a bug light. Then Tony Shaindinks ran through them, slapping them, shoving them, telling them to get the hell back, to return to the barracks, and that was an order. He was trying to get his own sunglasses on and kept missing his face with them. He got them where they belonged only after poking one bow into his mouth and the other into his left eyebrow. Sandy saw and heard none of that. What he heard was the hum. What he saw were the flashes, turning the ground mist smoke into electric dragons. What he saw was the column of stuttery purple light rising from the conical roof vent, stabbing up into the darkening air. Tony grabbed him, shook him. Another silent gun shell of light went off in the shed, turning the lenses of Tony's sunglasses into small, blue fireballs. He was shouting, although there was no need to. Sandy could hear him perfectly. There was the humming sound, and someone murmuring, "Good God Almighty." And that was all. "Sandy, were you here when this started?" "Yes," he found himself shouting back in spite of himself. The situation somehow demanded that they shout. The light flared and glared, mute lightning. Each time it went off, the barracks seemed to jump forward like something that was alive, the shadows of the troopers running up its bored side. "What started it? What set it off?" "I don't know." "Get inside. Call Curtis. Tell him what's happening. Tell him to get his ass over here now." Sandy resisted the urge to tell his SC that he wanted to stay and see what happened next. In a very elementary way, the idea was stupid to begin with. You couldn't actually see anything. It was too bright. Even with sunglasses, it was too bright. Besides, he knew an order when he heard it. He went inside, stumbling over the steps. It was impossible to judge depth or distance in those brilliant stutter flashes, and shuffled his way to dispatch, waving his arms in front of him. In his swimming, dazzled eyesight, the barracks was nothing but overlaid shadows. The only visual reality for him at that moment was the great purple flashes floating in front of him. Matt Babicki's radio was an endless blare of static with a few voices sticking out of it like the feet or fingers of buried men. Sandy picked up the regular telephone beside the dedicated 911 line, thinking that would be out too. Sure it would. But it was fine. He dialed Kurt's number from the list tacked to the bulletin board. Even the telephone seemed to jump with fright each time one of those purple-white flashes lit the room. Michelle answered the phone and said Kurt was out back, mowing the grass before it got dark. She didn't want to call him in, that was clear in her voice. But when Sandy asked her a second time, she said, "All right, just a minute, don't you guys ever give it a rest?" The wait seemed interminable to Sandy. The thing in Shed B kept flashing like some crazy neon apocalypse, and the room seemed to waver into a slightly different perspective every time it did. Sandy found it nearly impossible to believe something generating such brilliance could be anything but destructive. Yet he was still alive and breathing. He touched his cheeks with the hand not holding the telephone, checking for burns or swelling. There was neither. "For the time being, at least," he told himself. He kept waiting for the cops outside to begin screaming as if the thing in the old garage exploded or melted or let something out, something unimaginable with burning electric eyes. Such ideas were a million miles from the usual run of cop thoughts, but Sandy Dearborn had never felt less like a cop and more like a scared little boy. At last, Kurt picked up the telephone, sounding both curious and out of breath. "You have to come right now," Sandy told him. "Sarge says so." Kurt knew what it was about immediately. "What's it doing, Sandy?" "Shooting off fireworks, flashes and sparks. You can't even look at Shed B." "Is the building on fire?" "I don't think so, but there's no way to tell for sure. You can't see inside. It's too bright. Get over here." The phone at Kurt's end crashed down without another word spoken, and Sandy went back outside. If they were going to be nuked, he decided. He wanted to be with his friends when it happened. Kurt came roaring up the driveway marked Troopers Only 10 minutes later, behind the wheel of his lovingly restored Bel Air. the one his son would inherit 22 years later. When he came around the corner, he was still moving fast, and Sandy had one horrible moment when he thought Curtis was going to clean out about 5 guys with his bumper. But Kurt was quick on the brake. He still had a kid's reflexes, and brought the Chevy to a nose-dipping halt. He got out of his car, remembering to turn off the engine but not the headlights, tripping over his own eager feet and almost sprawling on the macadam. He caught his balance and went running toward the shed. Sandy had just time to see what was dangling from one hand, a pair of welder's goggles on an elastic strap. Sandy had seen excited men in his time, sure plenty. Almost every guy you stopped for speeding was excited in one way or another. But he had never seen anyone as burning with it as Kurt was then. His eyes seemed to be bulging right out of his face, and his hair appeared to be standing on end, although that might have been an illusion caused by how fast he was running. Tony reached out and grabbed him on the way by, almost spilling him again. Sandy saw Kurt's free hand close into a fist and start to rise. Then it relaxed. Sandy didn't know how close the rookie had come to striking his sergeant and didn't want to know. What mattered was that he recognized Tony and Tony's authority over him and stood down. Tony reached for the goggles. Kurt shook his head. Tony said something to him. Kurt replied, shaking his head vehemently. In the still bright flashes, Sandy saw Tony Shandings undergo his own brief struggle, wanting to simply order Kurt to hand the goggles over. Instead, he swung around and looked at his gathered troopers. In his haste and excitement, the SC had given them what could have been construed as 2 orders, to get back and to return to the barracks. Most had chosen to obey the first and ignore the second. Tony took a deep breath, let it out, then spoke to Dickie Duck Elliott, who listened, nodded, and went back into the barracks. The rest of them watched Kurt run toward Shed B, dropping his baseball cap on the pavement as he went and slipping the goggles over his eyes. Much as Sandy liked and respected the newest member of Troop D, he did not see anything heroic in this advance, not even while it was happening. Heroism is the act of going forward in the face of fear. Kurt Wilcox felt no fear that night, not the slightest twinge of it. He was simply bugshit with excitement and a curiosity so deep it was a compulsion. Much later, Sandy would decide the old Sarge had let Curtis go because he saw there was no chance of holding him back. Kurt stopped about 10 feet in front of the roll-up door, raising his hands to block his eyes as a particularly brilliant flash erupted from inside the shed. Sandy saw the light shining through Kurt's fingers and purple-white spokes. At the same time, Kurt's shadow appeared on the mist like the figure of a giant. Then the light died, and through a bolt of afterimage, Sandy saw Kurt advance again. He reached the door and looked inside. He stood that way until the next flash came. He recoiled when it did, then at once went back to the window. Meanwhile, here came Dickie Duck Elliott back from his errand, whatever it had been. Sandy saw what he was holding as Dickie Duck went past. The Sarge insisted that all of his D cars should go out equipped with Polaroid cameras, and Dickie Duck had run to fetch one of them. He handed it to Tony, cringing involuntarily as the shed lit up in another silent fusillade of light. Tony took the camera and jogged across to Curtis, who was still peering into the shed and recoiling at each new flash, or series of them. Even the welder's goggles weren't enough protection from what was going on in there, it seemed. Something nuzzled Sandy's hand, and he almost screamed before looking down and seeing the barracks dog. Mr. Dillon had likely slept through the whole thing until then, snoring on the linoleum between the sink and the stove, his favorite spot. Now he'd emerged to see what all the excitement was about. It was clear to Sandy from the brilliance of his eyes, the peak of his ears, and the high set of his head that he knew something was going on. But his previous terror wasn't in evidence. The flashing lights didn't seem to bother him in the slightest. Curtis tried to grab the Polaroid, but Tony wouldn't let go. They stood there in front of the Shed B door, turned into flinching silhouettes by each new flash from the shed. Arguing? Sandy didn't think so. Not quite, anyway. It looked to him like they were having the sort of heated discussion any two scientists might have while observing some new phenomenon. Or maybe it's not a phenomenon at all, Sandy thought. Maybe it's an experiment. And we're the guinea pigs. He began to measure the length of the dark intervals as he and the others stood watching the two men in front of the shed, one wearing an oversized pair of goggles and the other holding a boxy Polaroid camera, both of them outlined like figures on a laser-lit dance floor. The flashes had been like chain lightning when they began, but now there were significant pauses. Sandy counted 6 seconds between. 10 seconds. 7. 14. 20. Beside him, Buck Flanders said, "I think it's ending." Mr. D barked and made as if to start forward. Sandy grabbed him by the collar and held him back. Maybe the dog just wanted to go to Kurt and Tony, but maybe it was the thing in the shed he wanted to go to. Maybe it was calling him again. Sandy didn't care which. He liked Mr. Dillon right where he was. Tony and Kurt went around to the walk-in door. There they engaged in another warm discussion. At last, Tony nodded, reluctantly, Sandy thought, and handed over the camera. Kurt opened the door, and as he did, the thing flashed out again, burying him in a glare of brilliant light. Sandy fully expected him to be gone when it died out, disintegrated or perhaps teleported to a galaxy far, far away where he'd spend the rest of his life lubing X-Wing fighters or maybe polishing Darth Vader's shiny black ass. He had just time to register Kurt still standing there, one hand upraised to shield his goggled eyes. To his right and slightly behind him, Tony Shandings was caught in the act of turning away from the glare, hands upraised to shield his face. Sunglasses were simply no protection. Sandy was wearing his own and knew that. When he could see again, Kurt had gone into the shed. At that moment, all of Sandy's attention switched to Mr. Dillon, who was lunging forward in spite of the hold Sandy had on his collar. The dog's former calm was gone. He was growling and whining, ears flat against his skull, muzzle wrinkled back to show the white wink of teeth. "Help me! Help me out here!" Sandy shouted. Buck Flanders and Phil Candleton also grabbed Mr. D's collar, but at first it made no difference. The dog went motoring on, coughing and dripping slobber on the pavement, eyes fixed on the side door. He was ordinarily the sweetest mutt in creation, but right then, Sandy wished for a leash and a muzzle. If Dee turned to bite, one of them was apt to wind up a finger or two shy. "Shut the door," Sandy bawled at the sergeant. "If you don't want Dee in there with him, shut the damn door." Tony looked startled, then saw what was wrong and closed the door. Almost at once, Mr. Dillon relaxed. The growling stopped, then the whining. He gave out a couple of puzzled barks as if he couldn't remember exactly what had been bugging him. Sandy wondered if it was the hum, which was appreciably louder with the door open, or some smell. He thought the latter, but there was no way of telling for sure. The Buick wasn't about what you knew, but what you didn't. Tony saw a couple of men moving forward and told them to stay back. Hearing his normal speaking voice so clearly was calming, but it still seemed wrong. Sandy couldn't help feeling that there should have been whoops and screams in the background, movie soundtrack explosions, perhaps rumbles from the outraged earth itself. Tony turned back to the windows running along the roll-up door and peered in.
"What's he doing, Sarge?" Matt Babicki asked. "He all right?"
"He's fine," Tony said. "Walking around the car, taking pictures. What are you doing out here, Matt? Get in on dispatch, for Christ's sake."
"The radio's foobar, boss. Static."
"Well, maybe it's getting better," because this is getting better. To Sandy, he sounded normal on top, like the sergeant, but underneath that excitement still throbbed in his voice. And as Matt turned away, Tony added, "Not a word about this goes out over the air, you hear me? Not in the clear, anyway, now or ever. If you have to talk about the Buick, it's code D. You understand?" "Yes, sir," Matt said, and went up the back steps with his shoulders slumped, as if he had been spanked. "Sandy," Tony called, "what's up with the dog?" "Dog's fine. Now, what's up with the car?" "The car also appears to be fine. Nothing's burning, and there's no sign anything exploded. The thermometer says 54 degrees. It's cold in there, if anything." "Well, if a car is fine, why is he taking pictures of it?" Buck asked. "Why's a crooked letter that can't be made straight?" Sergeant Shane Dinks replied, as if this explained everything. He kept his eye on Curtis, who went on circling the car like a fashion photographer circling a model, snapping photos, tucking each Polaroid as it came out of the slot into the waistband of the old khaki shorts he was wearing. While this was going on, Tony allowed the rest of those present to approach by fours and take a look. When Sandy's turn came, he was struck by how Curtis's ankles lit up green each time the Buick flashed out. "Radiation," he thought. "Jesus Christ, he's got radiation burns." Then he remembered what Kurt had been doing earlier and had to laugh. Michelle hadn't wanted to call him into the phone because he was mowing the grass, and that was what was on his ankles, grass stains. "Come out of there," Phil muttered from Sandy's left. He still had the dog by the collar, although now Mr. D seemed quite docile. "Come out of there. Don't be pressing your luck." Kurt started backing toward the door as if he'd heard Phil, or all of them, thinking that same thing. More likely, he was just out of film. As soon as he came through the door, Tony put an arm around his shoulders and pulled him aside. As they stood there talking, a final weak pulse of purple light came. It was really no more than a twitch. Sandy looked at his watch. It was 9:10. The entire event had lasted not quite an hour. Tony and Kurt were looking at the Polaroids with an intensity Sandy couldn't understand. If, that was, Tony had been telling the truth when he said the Buick and the other stuff in the shed were unchanged. And to Sandy, all of it did look unchanged. At last, Tony nodded as if something was settled and walked back to the rest of the troopers. Kurt, meanwhile, went to the roll-up door for a final peek. The welder's goggles were pushed up on his forehead by then. Tony ordered everyone back into the barracks except for George Stankowski and Herb Avery. Herb had come in from patrol while the light show was still going on, probably to take a dump. Herb would drive 5 miles out of his way to take a dump at the barracks. He was famous for it and took all ribbing stoically. He said you could get diseases from strange toilet seats, and anyone who didn't believe that deserved what he got. Sandy thought Herb was simply partial to the magazines and the upstairs crapper. Trooper Avery, who would be killed in a rollover car crash 10 years later, was an American Heritage man. "You two have got the first watch," Tony said. "Sing out if you see anything peculiar, even if you only think it's peculiar." Herb groaned at getting sentry duty and started to protest. "Put a sock in it," Tony said, pointing at him. "Not one more word." Herb noted the red spots on the SC's cheeks and closed his mouth at once. Sandy thought that showed excellent sense. Matt Babicki was talking on the radio as the rest of them crossed the ready room behind Sergeant Shane Dinks. When Matt told Unit 6 to state his 20, Andy Gallucci's response was strong and perfectly clear. The static had cleared out again. They filled the seats in the little living room upstairs, those last in line having to content themselves with grabbing patches of rug. The ready room downstairs was bigger and had more chairs, but Sandy thought Tony's decision to bring the crew up here was a good one. This was family business, not police business. Not strictly police business, at least. Curtis Wilcox came last, holding his Polaroids in one hand, goggles still pushed up on his forehead, rubber flip-flops on his green feet. His T-shirt read, Horlicks University Athletic Department. He went to the sergeant, and the two of them conferred in murmurs while the rest waited. Then Tony turned back to the others. There was no explosion, and neither Kurt nor I think there was any sort of radiation leak either. Big sighs of relief greeted this, but several of the troopers still looked doubtful. Sandy didn't know how he looked. There was no mirror handy, but he still felt doubtful. Pass these around if you want, Kurt said, and handed out his stack of Polaroids by twos and threes. Some had been taken during the flashes and showed almost nothing. A glimmer of grillwork, a piece of the Buick's roof. Others were much clearer. The best had that odd, flat, declamatory quality which is the sole property of Polaroid photographs. I see a world where there's only cause and effect, they seem to say. A world where every object is an avatar and no gods move behind the scenes. Like conventional film or the badges workers in radiation-intensive environments have to wear, Tony said, Polaroid stock fogs when it's exposed to strong gamma radiation. Some of these photos are overexposed, but none of them are fogged. We're not hot, in other words. Phil Candleton said, No offense to you, Sarge, but I'm not crazy about trusting my nads to the Polaroid Corporation of America. I'll go up to the Berg tomorrow, first thing, and buy a Geiger counter, Kurt said. He spoke calmly and reasonably, but they could still hear the pulse of excitement in his voice. Under the cool, will you please step out of your car, sir, voice, Kurt Wilcox was close to blowing his top. They sell them at the Army Surplus Store on Grand. I think they go for around $300. I'll take the money out of the contingency fund if no one objects. No one did. In the meantime, Tony said, it's more important than ever that we keep this quiet. I believe that either by luck or providence, that thing has fallen into the hands of men who can actually do that. Will you? There were murmurs of agreement. Dickie Duck was sitting cross-legged on the floor, stroking Mr. Dillon's head. Dee was asleep with his muzzle on his paws. For the barracks mascot, the excitement was definitely over. I'm all right with that as long as the needle on the old Geiger counter doesn't move out of the green, Dickie Duck said. If it does, I vote we call the feds. Do you think they can take care of it any better than we can? Kurt asked hotly. Jesus Christ, Dickie, the Phoebes can't get out of their own way, and unless you have plans to lead-line Ched B out of the contingency fund, someone else began. That's pretty stupid, Kurt began, but then Tony put a hand on his shoulder, stilling the kid before he could go any further and maybe hurt himself. If it's hot, Tony promised them, we'll get rid of it. That's a promise. Kurt gave him a betrayed look. Tony stared back calmly. We know it's not radioactive, that gaze said. The film proves it. So why do you want to start chasing your own tail?
Well, I sort of think we ought to turn it over to the government anyway, Buck said. They might be able to help us, find stuff out. Defense stuff.
His voice getting smaller and smaller as he sensed the silent disapproval all around him. PSP officers worked with the federal government in one form or another every day. FBI, IRS, DEA, OSHA, and most of all, the Interstate Commerce Commission. It didn't take many years on the job to learn most of those federal boys were not smarter than the average bear. Sandy's opinion was that when the feds did show the occasional flash of intelligence, it tended to be self-serving, and sometimes downright malicious. Mostly they were slaves to the grind, worshippers at the altar of routine procedure. Before joining the PSP, Sandy had seen the same sort of dull, go-through-the-proper-channels thinking in the Army. Also, He wasn't much older than Curtis himself, which made him young enough to hate the idea of giving the roadmaster up. Better to hand it over to scientists in the private sector, though, if it came to that. Perhaps even a bunch from the college advertised on the front of Curtis's lawn-mowing shirt. But best of all, the troop. The Gray family. Buck had petered out into silence.
"Oh, not a good idea, I guess," he said.
"Don't worry," someone said. "You do win the Grolier Encyclopedia in our exciting home game." Tony waited for a few chuckles to ripple across the room and die away before going on. "I want everyone who works out of this barracks to know what went on tonight, so they'll know what to expect if it happens again. Spread the word. Spread the code for the Buick as well. D, as in dog. Just D, right? And I'll let you all know what happens next, starting with the Geiger counter. That test will be made before second shift tomorrow, I guarantee it. We're not going to tell our wives or sisters or brothers or best friends off the force what we have here, gentlemen, but we are going to keep each other exquisitely well-informed. That's my promise to you. We're going to do it the old-fashioned way, by verbal report. There has been no paperwork directly concerning the vehicle out there, if it is a vehicle, and that's how it's going to stay. All understood?" There was another murmur of agreement. "I won't tolerate a blabbermouth in Troop D, gentlemen. No gossip and no pillow talk. Is that understood?" It seemed it was. "Look at this one," Phil said suddenly, holding up one of the Polaroids. "The trunk's open." Kurt nodded. "Closed again now, though. It opened during one of the flashes, and I think it closed during the next one." Sandy thought of Ennis and had an image, very brief, but very clear, of the Buick's trunk lid opening and closing like a hungry mouth. See the living crocodile. Take a good look, but for God's sake, don't stick your fingers in there. Kurt went on. "I also believe the windshield wipers ran briefly, although my eyes were too dazzled by then for me to be sure, and none of the pictures show it." "Why?" Phil asked. "Why would stuff like that happen?" "Electrical surge," Sandy guessed. "The same thing that screwed up the radio in dispatch." "Maybe the wipers, but the trunk of a car doesn't run on electricity. When you want to open the trunk, you just push the button and lift the lid." Sandy had no answer for that. "The temperature in the shed has gone down another couple of degrees," Kurt said. "That'll bear watching." The meeting ended, and Sandy went back out on patrol. Every now and then, when radioing back to base, he'd ask Matt Babicki if D was five by. The response was always, "Roger, D is five by five." In later years, it would become a standard call and response in the Short Hills area surrounding Statler, Pogus City, and Patchen. A few other barracks eventually picked it up, even a couple over the Ohio state line. They took it to mean, "Is everything cool back home?" This amused the men working out of Troop D, because that was what "Is D still five by?" did mean. By the next morning, everyone in Troop D was indeed in the picture, but it was business as usual. Kurt and Tony went to Pittsburgh to get a Geiger counter. Sandy was off shift, but stopped by two or three times to check on the Buick just the same. It was quiet in there, the car simply sitting on the concrete and looking like an art exhibit. But the needle on the big red thermometer hung from the beam continued to ease down. That struck everyone as extremely eerie, silent confirmation that something was going on in there. Something beyond the ability of mere state troopers to understand, let alone control. No one actually went inside the shed until Kurt and Tony got back in Kurt's Bel Air, SC's orders. Huddy Royer was looking through the shed windows at the Buick when the two of them turned up. He strolled over as Kurt opened the carton sitting on the hood of his car and took the Geiger counter out. "Where's your Andromeda strain suits?" Huddy asked. Kurt looked at him, not smiling. That's a riot, he said. Kurt and the sergeant spent an hour in there running the Geiger counter all over the Buick's hull, cruising the pickup over the engine, taking it into the cabin, checking the seats and dashboard and weird oversized wheel. Kurt went underneath on a crawly gator, and the sergeant checked the trunk, being especially careful about that. They propped the lid up with one of the rakes on the wall. The counter's needle hardly stirred during any of this. The only time the steady cluck, cluck, cluck coming from its little speaker intensified was when Tony held the pickup close to the radium dial of his wristwatch, wanting to make sure the gadget was working. It was, but the roadmaster had nothing to tell it. They broke only once to go inside and get sweaters. It was a hot day outside, but in Shed B, the needle of the thermometer had settled just a hair below 48. Sandy didn't like it, and when the two of them came out, he suggested that they roll up the doors and let in some of the day's heat. Mr. Dillon was snoozing in the kitchenette, Sandy said. They could close him in there. No, Tony said, and Sandy could see that Curtis went along with that call. Why not? I don't know. Just a feeling. By 3 that afternoon, while Sandy was dutifully printing his name in the duty book under second shift 3P to 11P, and getting ready to head out on patrol, the temperature in Shed B had dropped to 47. That was 40 degrees colder than the summer day on the other side of those thin wooden walls. It must have been around 6 o'clock, while Sandy was parked around the side of Jimmy's diner on the old Statler Pike, drinking coffee and watching for speeders, that the roadmaster gave birth for the first time. Archie Arcanian was the first person to see the thing that came out of the Buick, although he didn't know what he was seeing. Things were quiet at the Troop D barracks. Not serene, exactly, but quiet. This was due in large measure to Kurt and Tony's report of zero radiation emanating from Shed B. Archie had come in from his trailer in Dreamland Park on top of the bluffs, wanting his own little off-duty peek at the impounded car. He had it to himself. Shed B was, for the time being, entirely deserted. 40 yards away, the barracks was mid-shift quiet, which was about as quiet as it ever got. Matt Babicki had clocked out for the night, and one of the younger cops was running dispatch. The sarge had gone home at 5 o'clock. Kurt, who had given his wife some cock-and-bull story about his call-out the night before, was presumably back in his flip-flop sandals and finishing his lawn like a good boy. At 7:05, the Troop D custodian, by then very pale, very thoughtful, and very scared, went past the kid in the dispatch cubby and into the kitchenette to see who he could find. He wanted someone who wasn't a rookie, someone who knew the score. He found Huddy Royer just putting the finishing touches on a big pot of Kraft macaroni and cheese.